And so the women of the palace and members of the state council began to suspect that the spirit of some powerful city, which is man who possesses supernormal powers. As for Sankara, he had become so wholly engrossed in his study, that he had entirely forgotten his personality and had no desire to reintegrate the ascetic philosopher's body that he had left in charge of a few disciples. When their guru did not return at the appointed time, the disciples felt rather uneasy, and on hearing of the search they were thoroughly terrified. They ran quickly to the Raja's residency, gained admittance before him and sang a philosophic song which Sankara had composed. This aroused the guru's memory. His spirit sprang out of the Raja's body and swiftly entered his own, which had just been discovered and was already placed on a pyre to be burned. Having thus completely mastered his subject, he confronted Bharati once more and astonished her by his superior knowledge. The lady had to admit she was defeated. This tale could easily take its place among those of Boccaccio. Yet, for hundreds of years, it has been popular amongst Sankara's followers without their seeing anything silly or shocking in it. However, they are apparently beginning to realize that the story is not very creditable to the memory of their teacher, and some of them have declared that it was invented by certain simple-minded zealots. For us, the story is valuable as a piece of information. It shows that the belief in the passing of some subtle self from one body to another, and even in its roaming about disembodied, was current in India. Such belief was not infrequent in Tibet, where the translation of the self from one body to another one is called Drongjug. Possibly the theories regarding Drongjug have been imported from India. Milarepa, in his autobiography, relates that his guru Marpa was not taught the secret of Drongjug by his own teacher Naroda, but when already old, made a journey to India to learn it. It is to be noted that believers in the translation of an ethereal self or double, generally depict the body from which it withdraws, as remaining inanimate. Here lies the essential difference between that supposed phenomenon and the apparitions, voluntary or unconsciously created, of a talpa, either alike or different from its creator. In fact, while the translation as related in Indian or Tibetan stories, may well be regarded as a fable, the creation of talpas seems worthy of investigation. Phantoms, as Tibetans describe them, and those that I have myself seen do not resemble the apparitions which are said to occur during spiritualist seances. In Tibet, the witnesses of these phenomena have not been especially invited to endeavor to produce them, or to meet a medium known for producing them. Consequently, their minds are not prepared and intent on seeing apparitions. There is no table upon which the company lay their hands, nor any medium in trance, nor a dark closet in which the latter is shut up. Darkness is not required, sun and open air do not keep away the phantoms. As I have said, some apparitions are created on purpose either by a lengthy process resembling that described in the former chapter on the visualization of Yidam, or, in the case of proficient adepts, instantaneously or almost instantaneously. In other cases, apparently the author of the phenomenon generates it unconsciously, and is not even in the least aware of the apparition being seen by others. In connection with this kind of visualization or thought form creation, I may relate a few phenomena which I have witnessed myself. 1. A young Tibetan who was in my service went to see his family. I had granted him 3 weeks' leave, after which he was to purchase a food supply, engage porters to carry the loads across the hills, and come back with the caravan. Most likely the fellow had a good time with his people. 2 months elapsed and still he did not return. I thought he had definitely left me. Then I saw him one night in a dream. He arrived at my place clad in a somewhat unusual fashion, wearing a sun hat of foreign shape. He had never worn such a hat. The next morning, one of my servants came to me in haste. "Wangdi has come back," he told me. "I have just seen him down the hill." The coincidence was strange. I went out of my room to look at the traveler. The place where I stood dominated a valley. I distinctly saw Wangdi. He was dressed exactly as I had seen him in my dream. He was alone and walking slowly up the path that wound up the hill slope. I remarked that he had no luggage with him, and the servant who was next me answered, "Wang Di has walked ahead. The load carriers must be following." We both continued to observe the man. He reached a small curtain, walked behind it and did not reappear. The base of this curtain was a queue built in stone, less than 3 feet high, and from its needle-shaped top to the ground, the small monument was no more than 7 feet high. There was no cavity in it. Moreover, the curtain was completely isolated. There were neither houses, nor trees, nor undulations, nor anything that could provide a hiding in the vicinity. My servant and I believed that Wang Du was resting for a while under the shade of the curtain. But as time went by without his reappearing, I inspected the ground round the monument with my field glasses, but discovered nobody. Very much puzzled, I sent two of my servants to search for the boy. I followed their movements with the glasses, but no trace was to be found of Wang Du nor of anybody else. That same day, a little before dusk, the young man appeared in the valley with his caravan. He wore the very same dress and the foreign sun hat which I had seen in my dream, and in the morning vision. Without giving him or the load carriers time to speak with my servants and hear about the phenomenon, I immediately questioned them. From their answers I learned that all of them had spent the previous night in a place too far distant from my dwelling for anyone to reach the latter in the morning. It was also clearly stated that Wang Di had continually walked with the party. During the following weeks I was able to verify the accuracy of the men's declarations by inquiring about the time of the caravan's departure, at the few last stages where the porters were changed. It was proved that they had all spoken the truth and had left the last stage together with Wang Du, as they said. I noticed behind him the somewhat nebulous shape of one of the fantastic beings which often appeared in his paintings. I made a startled gesture and the astonished artist took a few steps towards me, asking what was the matter. I noticed that the phantom did not follow him, and quickly thrusting my visitor aside, I walked to the apparition with one arm stretched in front of me. My hand reached the foggy form. I felt as if touching a soft object whose substance gave way under the slight push, and the vision vanished. The painter confessed in answer to my questions that he had been performing a Dathab rite during the last few weeks, calling on the deity whose form I had dimly perceived, and that very day he had worked the whole morning on a painting of the same deity. In fact, the Tibetan's thoughts were entirely concentrated on the deity whose help he wished to secure for a rather mischievous undertaking. He himself had not seen the phantom. In these two cases, the phenomenon was produced without the conscious cooperation of its author. Or, as a mystic lama remarked, Wang Du and the painter could hardly be termed the authors of the phenomena. They were but one cause, maybe the principal one, amongst the various causes which had brought them about. 3. The third strange occurrence I have to relate belongs to the category of phenomena which are voluntarily produced. The fact that the apparition appeared in the likeness of the lama who caused it, must not lead us to think that he projected a subtle double of himself. This is not the opinion of advanced adepts in Tibetan secret lore. According to them, such phantoms are talpas, magic formations generated by a powerful concentration of thought. As it had been repeatedly stated in the preceding chapters, any forms may be visualized through that process. At that time I was camping near Panagritodankam. One afternoon, I was with my cook in a hut which we used as a kitchen. The boy asked me for some provisions. I answered, "Come with me to my tent, you can take what you need out of the boxes." We walked out, and when nearing my tent, we both saw the hermit lama seated on a folding chair next my camp table. This did not surprise us because the lama often came to talk with me. The cook only said, "Rinpoche is there, I must go and make tea for him at once. I will take the provisions later on." I replied, "All right. Make tea and bring it to us." The man turned back and I continued to walk straight toward the lama, looking at him all the time while he remained seated motionless. When I was only a few steps from the tent, a flimsy veil of mist seemed to open before it, like a curtain that is pulled aside. And suddenly I did not see the lama anymore, he had vanished. A little later, the cook came, bringing tea. He was surprised to see me alone. As I did not like to frighten him, I said, "Rinpoche only wanted to give me a message. He had no time to stay to tea." I related the vision to the Lama, but he only laughed at me without answering my questions. Yet, upon another occasion he repeated the phenomenon. He utterly disappeared as I was speaking with him in the middle of a wide bare tract of land, without tent or houses or any kind of shelter in the vicinity. The creation of a phantom yidam, as we have seen it described in the previous chapter, has two different objects. The higher one consists in teaching the disciples that there are no gods or demons other than those which his mind creates. The second aim, less enlightened, is to provide oneself with a powerful means of protection. How does the phantom of the deity protect its creator? By appearing instead of the latter. It is the custom in Tibet that the lamas who are initiated to that peculiar practice put on each morning the personality of their yidam. This being done, the evil spirits who happen to meet these lamas do not see them as men, but under the frightful shape of the terrible deities, a sight which of course prevents them from attempting any mischief. Expert magicians in this art can, it is said, hide their own real appearance under any illusory form they choose. Among the many who, each morning, gravely take on the shape of their yidam, probably very few are really capable of showing themselves as such. I do not know if they succeed in duping the demons, but they certainly do not create any illusion to human eyes. Yet I have heard that some lamas have been seen in the appearance of certain deities of the Lamaist pantheon. Incited by many wonderful legends regarding the power of ancient Tubthobs to create Tulpas, a small number of Gagspas and Lamas endeavor, in great secrecy, to succeed in that peculiar branch of esoteric lore. However, the practice is considered as fraught with danger for everyone who has not reached a high mental and spiritual degree of enlightenment and is not fully aware of the nature of the psychic forces at work in the process. Once the Tulpa is endowed with enough vitality to be capable of playing the part of a real being, it tends to free itself from its maker's control. This, say Tibetan occultists, happens nearly mechanically, just as the child, when his body is completed and able to live apart, leaves its mother's womb. Sometimes the phantom becomes a rebellious son and one hears of uncanny struggles that have taken place between magicians and their creatures. The former being severely hurt or even killed by the latter. Tibetan magicians also relate cases in which the Tulpa is sent to fulfill a mission, but does not come back and pursues its peregrinations as a half-conscious, dangerously mischievous puppet. The same thing, it is said, may happen when the maker of the Tulpa dies before having dissolved it. Yet, as a rule, the phantom either disappears suddenly at the death of the magician or gradually vanishes like a body that perishes for want of food. On the other hand, some Tulpas are expressly intended to survive their creator and are specially formed for that purpose. These may be considered as veritable Tulkas, see a famous Tibetan monastery on page 58. And, in fact, the demarcation between Tulpas and Tulkas is far from being clearly drawn. The existence of both is grounded on the same theories. Must we credit these strange accounts of rebellious materializations, phantoms which have become real beings, or must we reject them all as mere fantastic tales and wild products of imagination? Perhaps the latter course is the wisest. I affirm nothing. I only relate what I have heard from people whom, in other circumstances, I had found trustworthy, but they may have deluded themselves in all sincerity. Nevertheless, allowing for a great deal of exaggeration and sensational addition, I could hardly deny the possibility of visualizing and animating a Tulpa. Besides having had few opportunities of seeing thought forms, my habitual incredulity led me to make experiments for myself, and my efforts were attended with some success. In order to avoid being influenced by the forms of the Lamaist deities, which I saw daily around me in paintings and images, I chose for my experiment a most insignificant character, a monk, short and fat, of an innocent and jolly type. I shut myself in cells and proceeded to perform the prescribed concentration of thought and other rites. After a few months, the phantom monk was formed. His form grew gradually fixed and lifelike looking. He became a kind of guest, living in my apartment. I then broke my seclusion and started for a tour, with my servants and tents. The monk included himself in the party. Though I lived in the open riding on horseback for miles each day, the illusion persisted. I saw the fat tripper, now and then it was not necessary for me to think of him to make him appear. The phantom performed various actions of the kind that are natural to travelers and that I had not commanded. For instance, he walked, stopped, looked around him. The illusion was mostly visual, but sometimes I felt as if a robe was lightly rubbing against me and once a hand seemed to touch my shoulder. The features which I had imagined, when building my phantom, gradually underwent a change. The fat, chubby-cheeked fellow grew leaner. His face assumed a vaguely mocking, sly, malignant look. He became more troublesome and bold. In brief, he escaped my control. Once, a herdsman who brought me a present of butter saw the tulpa in my tent and took it for a live llama. I ought to have let the phenomenon follow its course, but the presence of that unwanted companion began to prove trying to my nerves. It turned into a day-night mare. Moreover, I was beginning to plan my journey to Lhasa and needed a quiet brain devoid of other preoccupations, so I decided to dissolve the phantom. I succeeded, but only after 6 months of hard struggle. My mind creature was tenacious of life. There is nothing strange in the fact that I may have created my own hallucination. The interesting point is that in these cases of materialization, others see the thought forms that have been created. Tibetans disagree in their explanations of such phenomena. Some think a material form is really brought into being, others consider the apparition as a mere case of suggestion, the creator's thought impressing others and causing them to see what he himself sees. In spite of the clever efforts made by the Tibetans to find rational explanations for all prodigies, a number remain unexplained, perhaps because they are pure inventions, or perhaps for other reasons. A Tibetan generally admits that highly advanced mystics need not die in the usual way, but may dissolve their bodies when and where they like and leave no traces. It is said that Rish Hungpa disappeared in this way and that during a special contemplative meditation Dagmidma, the wife of Lama Mapu, ended her life by incorporating herself in her husband. But these are all personalities of long past centuries. It is more interesting to hear about an occurrence of recent date. And the interest still increases when the prodigy, instead of taking place in some lonely hermitage, happened before hundreds of witnesses. I may say at once that I was not amongst the latter and that my information is derived from the account of men who affirmed that they saw the wonder. My only connection with the miraculous event is that I personally knew the Lama who is believed to have vanished in a mysterious way. The latter, styled Kyongbu Rinpoche, was one of the spiritual teachers and religious advisors of the Tashi Lama. When I visited Shigatse in 1916, he was already an old man and lived as a hermit, some miles away from that town, near the bank of the Yesru Tsangpo. The mother of the Tashi Lama held him in high reverence, and when I was her guest, I heard several extraordinary stories about the venerable Lama. It was reported that as years went by, the size of the learned ascetic gradually decreased. This, according to Tibetans, is a sign of great spiritual achievement, and legends relate how the bodies of some Dutubs who had been tall men, became reduced to minute proportions and finally disappeared. At that time, the new temple sheltering the huge image of the coming Buddha Maitreya was near completion and a consecration ceremony was being talked of. The Tashi Lama wished his old spiritual advisor to perform the consecration rite, but the latter declined, saying that he would have passed away before the temple could be finished. To this the Tashi Lama replied, it is said, by beseeching the hermit to delay his death till he had blessed the new building. Though such a request may astonish the reader, it is in accord with Tibetan ideas regarding the power which high mystics possess, of choosing the time of their death. The hermit promised to perform the consecration. Then, about 1 year after my visit to Shigatse, the temple being ready and a day appointed for the Rabban's 249. Abbreviation of Rabtan Nespa, spelt, Rabtan Aspa, to consecrate new buildings, images, etc. 249 Solemnity. The Tashi Lama sent a beautiful sedan chair and an escort to Kyongbu Rinpoche to bring him to Tashi Lumpo's Gompa. The men of the escort saw the Lama sitting in the chair. The latter was closed and the porters started. Now, thousands of people had gathered at Tashi Lumpo for the religious festival of inauguration. To their utmost astonishment, they saw the Lama coming alone and on foot. Silently he crossed the temple threshold, walked straight towards the giant image of Maitreya until his body touched it, and then gradually became incorporated with it. Some time later the sedan chair with the escort arrived. Attendants opened its door, the chair was empty. Many believe that the Lama has never been seen again. The occurrence was odd enough to hold my attention, but my interest was deepened by the fact that I had been acquainted with its hero and the initial circumstances that led up to the prodigy, that is to say with the request of the Tashi Lama regarding the consecration of the temple, and further because the place where the wonder is said to have happened, was familiar to me. I burned with the desire of going to Shigatse, to inquire about the Lama's last days, and discover his tomb, if he was really dead. But when I heard of the bizarre miracle, I was at Lhasa in disguise, and neither Yongdan nor I could have kept up our incognito in Shigatse, where we both had a number of acquaintances. To be unmasked meant to be immediately escorted over the border, and I intended, after my stay at Lhasa, to visit same monastery, and several others, in southern Tibet. Also to tour historical ground of the Yalung province. This compelled me to renounce any attempt at investigation. Yet, before we left Tibet, Yongdan managed to put some discreet questions about the Shigatse wonder to a few men who seemed capable of holding somewhat enlightened views on the subject. Unfortunately, the event was already several years old. Great changes had taken place in Tsang. Moreover, the political atmosphere was not favorable to Tsang. Men of rank had become exaggeratedly reserved about the least thing which could be interpreted as exalting the exiled Tashi Lama and those who were near to him. Nor did they dare increase the prestige of the Maitreya temple, whose erection, according to the public rumor, had aroused unfriendly and jealous feelings at the Lhasa court. We gathered the following opinions. 1. The Lama had created a phantom of himself which appeared to have entered the sedan chair, and then acted as has been told in the temple of Maitreya. This phantom had vanished, as its master wished, when touching the image, while the Lama may have all the time remained in his hermitage. 2. Or Kyongbu Rinpoche had been able to produce, from afar, a collective hallucination. 3. Some suggested that the Lama was already dead when the miracle took place, but had left behind him a kind of phantom of his creation, which he sent to Tashi Lumpo. 4. I also remember that a disciple of Kyongbu Rinpoche had told me that, by the means of certain kinds of concentration of mind, a phenomenon may be prepared in connection with a peculiar event which is to take place in the future. Once success is obtained with the concentration, the process goes on mechanically, without further cooperation of the man who has projected the energy required to bring about the phenomenon. It was even said that this man is, in most cases, completely incapable of preventing the phenomenon which he had planned to take place at the appointed time. The energy generated, which has shaped itself in a certain way, is now beyond his control. Much more could be said regarding psychic phenomena in Tibet, but the account of a single inquirer cannot be very complete, especially under the difficult conditions in which researches must be pursued in that country. I earnestly wish that my account may awaken in some scientists, more qualified than myself for such work, the desire to undertake serious investigations of the phenomena which I have briefly mentioned in the present book. Psychic research may be guided by the same spirit as any scientific study. The discoveries which can be made in that field have nothing of supernatural, nothing which may justify the superstitious beliefs and ramblings in which some have indulged regarding the matter. On the contrary, such a research may help to elucidate the mechanism of so-called miracles, and once explained, the miracle is no more a miracle.